Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader podcast with John Bates.
Welcome to the show. Just to get this out of the way, I'm sponsoring my own show. I don't want to be beholden to anybody else, but I'm sponsoring my own show. So if you're interested in getting some support around your leadership and your communication, if you'd like to go through what I think is the number one experience that any leader could ever go through, which is creating your own TED-like talk and all the things that go along with that, come visit me at executivespeakingsuccess.com and check out my online cohort-based courses at ed.executivespeakingsuccess.com. And now, I am thrilled to bring you someone whom I've known for a long, long time. It's sort of weird that I've known him for that long. I don't feel like I'm even that old. He is a New York Times best-selling author. His name is Brant Cooper, and he wrote The Lean Entrepreneur, which is a fabulous, fabulous book. He's the CEO and founder of Moves the Needle. He's a trusted advisor to startups and large enterprises around the world, and to me as well. And you can find him at brantcooper.com. He's also Brant Cooper, B-R-A-N-T-C-O-O-P-E-R, on social, on multiple channels. And he's got a new book coming out, which we're going to talk about. It's called Disruption Proof, which you tell me, Brant, but I think that was underway before COVID happened, and it just happened to be like insanely timely. Is that right?
Yeah, I wasn't intending to write a pandemic book, but I guess if you're writing during the pandemic, it's pretty hard not to. So yeah, there's some pandemic related things in there, and it was not called Disruption Proof when I started. So
yeah, okay, all right. So well, welcome, Brant. It's really great to have you. It's great to reconnect here. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much, John. It's always great to talk to you, and I'm super happy to be here and a fan of all your work.
Thank you. So listen, let's talk about the Lean Entrepreneur first for a second, because that is how I found you, and our mutual friend Kelly Abbott turned me on to you, and I got to meet you. I read your book. I fell in love with your ideas. We've worked together off and on now over the years. Tell me just a little bit about the Lean Entrepreneur for someone who maybe is an entrepreneur now, but didn't know that it was out there yet.
Yeah. So, comes from the startup background. I, lived through the dot-com boom and bust, and really in the end, the way I describe the Lean Entrepreneur is it takes the best from human-centered design, rapid experimentation, and then leveraging data to inform our decisions. We don't want data to make decisions for us. We can talk about that if we want to.
Yeah, but let's talk about that in a minute. That's a very good point.
But we need to use it to inform our decisions, to cut through our biases and all the rest. And so, yeah, it started out in the startup entrepreneurial world, but really the company I ended up building brought this to large enterprises. And so it's really, how do we cut through our assumptions about our ideas? How do we find a business model that works? How do we build products that matter? How do we understand the needs of our customers, but also other stakeholders, employees, shareholders, different people that might be involved in our ecosystem? So that's really what the Lean Entrepreneur was about, a deep dive into how to do that stuff.
Well, I'll never forget this story. You tell me if I get this right, but this is a story that I think I heard from you about being at a hackathon and there was this group that was doing a medical device, and they were sure that their client was going to be cardiac doctors. They had this cool thing for cardiac doctors. And you said to them, well, have you talked to any of your customers yet? And they said, no. And you said, well, go talk to them. And they're like, but it's a weekend. You said, go to the emergency room, right? And they went to the emergency room, talked to a bunch of people, went to a couple of hospitals, talked to people, came back having realized that their client was not going to be cardiac doctors. Their client was going to be emergency room nurses.
Yeah, I don't know if I told you that story, but it sure sounds familiar. I mean, I have, you know, there's just a million examples of that. And yeah, to be honest, there's a lot of people out there these days that are teaching this and doing this. It's certainly not, you know, me and my revolution. It's just I happen to be part of this bigger movement that brings human-centered design into the products. And then also just designs ways to cut through our assumptions and our biases. And that's how we find success.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm pretty sure that arose out of your organization. I maybe didn't hear it directly from you. But what is another, is there a good story you have that illustrates that cutting through our biases aspect of this whole thing?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I guess I think that there is, especially in the corporate environments, there just really is this propensity. The default action is to sit around a conference room table and talk and really just try to convince each other that what we know is right. And we will bring data to the table, but it'll be demographics or it'll be, you know, studies that are 20 years old.
Right.
And that's not really the type of evidence we're talking about. I think what's interesting perspective, I love all of the behavioral stuff that is going on. Yeah. If you're actually bringing a product to market, you are fundamentally trying to change somebody's behavior. Mm. And so the evidence that we're looking for is evidence that those people are willing and able to change their behavior. Maybe they're not able to change their behavior and you won't be able to sell to them, even if it's just an amazing product and the need is there. And so there's just so many layers to this idea of busting our own assumptions as well as cutting through our own biases. And really it's, you know, it's the scientific method. I put into scare quotes because it's not exactly that. But for the rest of the business, not just the tech side.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I'm resonating with aspects of this right now and what I'm doing, because I think that just given everything that's going on right now, the thing that I need to be doing is just calling people and reaching out and doing some of that stuff and asking some questions about what they need and what they got from me that they value. But that's hard. That's scary. I don't want to bother them. Oh, but you know, I really need to clean my desk. You know, I forgot. I promised my wife I would do some laundry. You know, it's like, anything but to go talk to the clients, which is one of the things that I really took away from the Lean Entrepreneur, is just go talk to them, man.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right on. I think it is hard. You know, one of the potential benefits, I mean, you have to be careful the way you say this, you know, that COVID was horrible and it continues to be horrible. But, you know, there are changes afoot being driven by the pandemic, and some of those changes are positive. And to a certain extent, even though everybody's got, you know, Zoom fatigue, the fact that everybody can get on video and is sort of willing to do it and able to do it means that reaching out to customers and clients is actually easier than it was before. And so there's even less of an excuse to do it now. but I think that, I mean, how long have you been in this particular business, John?
I mean, I've been doing this for a decade now.
Right. So the biggest learning that I've had over my decade of doing this is that these principles don't just apply to, you know, the big crazy innovation. It doesn't just apply to the super disruptive startups. And so, you know, we got to talk about that word disruption, but it applies to our everyday lives. And this is what the pandemic drove home, right? Is that suddenly the world has changed. So nobody cares about innovation 5 or 6 years from now if what we're trying to do is eat today, right? And so suddenly our core business faces this uncertainty, and you can't just buckle down and, you know, execute on what you know, because what you know has changed.
Yeah.
So the only thing we can do is to get back out in the market and act like entrepreneurs again.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Look, that's been niggling around at my consciousness, but to have you say that, like say that one more time, that's really, I think, important.
Right. So this entrepreneurial or innovation mindset isn't just for the great big next thing that's going to save us when we're getting disrupted by a tech startup. It's about our everyday business, because things like the pandemic have disrupted our core markets, our core business. And so we have to act like entrepreneurs again in order to just sort of firm up what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And so reaching out to customers and clients is step number one.
Amen, brother. And that brings us to disruption proof. So, you know, I mean, I think the other thing that goes hand in hand with that is that I don't think once we're through the pandemic, we're heading into a much more disruption-free future. No, you know, I think it's just ramping up. The pace of disruption of all kinds is just ramping up, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a fundamental point of the book. And listen, I'm a huge fan of Clayton Christensen. Innovator's Dilemma changed my view of the world. But that was also written in the 80s when we were going through massive technological disruption. And so, you know, there's still principles obviously there that apply, but I think that we're living in a new world now where our economies are going to be disrupted on a regular basis. And so this is not just things like the pandemic, but it's ships getting stuck in a canal that disrupts, supply chains. It's a ransomware attacks on gas pipelines or hospital systems. It's energy grid collapses. I mean, we're just so interconnected that we're living in that world where the butterfly flapping its wings in the Amazon, you know, creates chaos on the other side of the world. We can see that happening now. And so we can't sit back and wait for creating the next big thing. We actually have to bring that mindset to our core daily lives.
Yeah, I absolutely. And, you know, it reminds me of a book that I read that I think people could think of your book as an antidote to this. But it's a fabulous book. It's by one of my favorite authors, Jared Diamond. I think he's brilliant. And he wrote a book called Collapse. And the basic thing of it is that he looked at all these past ancient civilizations that just collapsed. And some happened fast, some happened slow, but they all seemed to coalesce around a certain pattern, which is that the society would get as interconnected and as far out as it could, you know, just pushing the boundaries of what was possible at the time. Then it would have a few good years, like good rain, good crops, like everything goes well for a few years, and then whammo, a drought or something, an external thing that ruined that good year streak. And because they were so at the absolute edge of what they could do, plus a little help from the good years, when that disruption happened, the society just ultimately collapsed from that. And so if we don't listen to your advice and we don't think about how to disruption proof our individual businesses, and then I think bring that to society and the world, we are, I think, at risk of imminent collapse.
It's hard to argue with that. I mean, I think it's, in some ways I might say it's Malthusian, you know, when we are living in an agricultural world and there's no way we're going to produce enough food, and then impossible to foresee the industrial age that actually enables us to go, you know, sort of another several generations, a century or two, right? But I really think that that's the moment we're in now. We are in this change, the throes of revolution from the industrial age to whatever we want to call this next age, right? Where we're that interconnected. And so I, you know, to me, the industrial age, was very hierarchical. It was very masculine, is one way of putting it. Very command and control. And the type of wars that we fought were that way. And it was all throughout society, our educational systems. You know, when I'm maybe dating myself, but when I was in elementary school, you had to walk down the hall on the right-hand side, single file, right? I mean, it's the same sort of thing. It's right, preparing us for the industrial age. Yeah. And of course, governments are very much built hierarchical in the same sort of way. And I think that the revolution that we're seeing, and this is not my idea, this is already happening everywhere, is this idea of decentralizing decision making, empowering the edge to make decisions where the problems crop up. And what that means is that the management and the structure of our institutions is fundamentally going to change if they are to survive.
Yeah. I mean, if command and control, top down, do what I say, if that ever worked, it's certainly not going to work now.
No, no. And again, I actually think, you know, when there was less uncertainty and less complexity, it was a natural way for the systems to evolve. So, I, just as a thought exercise, I like to think about Henry Ford's assembly line. You know, you can produce, you can have a Model T, any color you want, as long as it's black, right? So you have this assembly line that's constructed to build one item, right? And the idea, but Henry Ford's ingenious idea was, I need to create that vehicle as inexpensively as possible in order to be able to sell it to the mass market, right?
Yeah.
He knew that if he could produce the Model T cheap enough, his market was huge. So the risk was really in the technical ability to create the car and the organization of the company, which ended up being, you know, the management of the science of management. And you're going to build out your whole company to make sure that you can get the most output for every input you put in there, right? So you're managing for efficiency, and you create all your departments to market and sell and distribute and get parts and all of that rest in the idea of this efficiency model, most output I can get for my input.
Yeah.
Most companies are still managed the same way, and yet we're not producing one Model T in any color as long as it's black, right?
Right.
You've got like crazy amount of choices. Consumers are walking around with computers in their pockets. Yeah. They can choose from one vendor to another overnight, the number of models, the number of features, the number of options. Yeah. And so what that means is that companies are optimized for output versus input, are measuring the wrong thing. And the way we structure the companies is optimizing the wrong thing. And really what we just need to do is optimize for the efficiency of creating value for our customers. And suddenly things will start to change. If we simply measure the right thing, I think a lot of the way we organize around optimizing something like that is natural. But we, you know, we kind of got to kick him in the tail to get him going. But I think that that's what we're going to see. And I actually think a lot of the tech companies, for better or for worse, in terms of some of their behavior, are more naturally structured that way. Google's and Facebook's and Amazon's and Spotify's. And it's why, you know, they're not worried about disruptive innovation. What they're worried about is, what else can we do to grab more market share? And and they know that they actually have to create value at some level for customers, whether it's just cheaper prices or distribution or making life easier or whatever. That's what they're optimized for. And I do think that there's some downsides to that, and we need to mitigate some of that. But sort of in terms of the ethos of entrepreneurs and companies, it's the right way to be organized for the 21st century.
So, and you've got a couple of mental models for that. I think there are, is it the five E's?
Right. Yeah. So the five elements of this rad mindset. So the rad mindset is one that is resilient, so it can weather the storms of all these disruptions. It's aware. So the organization builds awareness into a model, so it knows what's changing, both in terms of internal dynamics as well as external events. These could be massive disruptions. They could be acts of God. They could be smaller changes in market, customer needs, demographic changes. And then dynamic is building into the institutions themselves this ability to change quickly based upon that new information. And so there's a set of behaviors, right? So there's a lot of these companies that are talking about transformation, but they do these top-down things where, you know, where they're just kind of like, come on, people, let's be more agile. And it just kind of doesn't work. We have to build this ethos, this behavior, this culture from the ground up that leads to this rad organization. And so the mindset is described by these five E's. Empathy. So understanding our customers or other stakeholders deeply. It doesn't mean doing what they say. It means understanding why they say what they say. It's exploration. So that's sort of admitting I don't know all of the answers. So I got to go out in the world and figure it out. It's evidence. So again, we mentioned that earlier, using evidence to cut through our biases and inform our decisions. Equilibrium. Equilibrium is a couple of different ways of looking at how we balance the execution work we know we have to get done with this exploration behavior. But it's also creating equilibrium for the human beings that are involved in our companies and understanding that people need to have balance in their lives in order to be happier people and better employees. And all the science shows that happier employees are way more productive. And a matter of fact, I think, again, we see this sort of in COVID that remote work has not, you know, meant the collapse of productivity. In many ways, it has increased productivity.
Yes.
And then the final E is ethics. And this is, you know, purposefully, consciously building in regulations around our behavior to ensure that we're you know, matching what our stated corporate values are as well as our own personal values. And we have to be more consciously putting that into the way we manage people and the way we manage teams so that it doesn't get out of our control. And really, to me, this is where getting back to those tech companies, they haven't added that last layer. And there ends up being this battle between the ethics of the individual or the values of the corporation run mutually exclusively opposed to the financial incentives, which tend to win out. And so there's, I think that there's ways that we can build the ethics into the system such that that doesn't happen.
Boy, you know, I don't want to go down this path exclusively, but that final one is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, particularly just the, you know, ethics and integrity and, you know, something beyond just the dollar and, you know, some empathy for fellow humans and some commitment to making the world a better place versus just feathering your own nest and things like that. And I look, it's always been a problem. I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we thought that somehow that was not a problem before and now it is. It's just like everything else. Now it's been amplified by the power of technology and the power of our connectivity and the incredible concentration of power to the individual, right? All of a sudden, each individual's ethics and integrity matters just a million times more than it ever did before because of the power that every individual has, right?
I think that's really true. And I think that, again, it may be Dan Ariely that wrote about the way human beings are wired to rationalize their behavior if that behavior sort of is unchecked. In other words, it's not sort of this conscious thing of like, oh, can I get away with this? It's being forced with a tough decision about how you're incentivized and how you're motivated and doing something and then just going, yeah, but this is kind of just the way we work and it's not that big of a deal and sort of whatever that rationalization that goes on. And so I think that, you know, one of my ideas is this idea that the team is the new unit of work. And so that you're managing teams of people rather than individuals. Mm. And I think that part of what we've done in the industrial age is we isolated down to the individual and what an individual is doing. And we've lost the social structure that allows this to hold each other accountable. And I think if you have a group of people that is, you know, reminded of and where their mission has a ethical element to it, then I think it's more natural for that group to hold each other accountable to those ideas. You're already less in the dark than if you're the individual going like, okay, well, I just think I got to do it this way. And so I think that building that team and building the ethics into that team and then having a team of teams where again, the ethics are reinforced. It's this ground up way of ensuring that we're adhering to values versus this sort of the top-down declaratory statements. Like, listen, I'm naive, John, but I actually think somewhere in Mark Zuckerberg's heart of hearts, he believes in building communities. And he really believes that that is what Facebook's primary mission is to build communities that make people feel more connected. And all of the advertising that Facebook runs, and certainly through the Olympics, was based upon that community feel. And I think even if Mark doesn't believe it anymore, certainly tens of thousands of Facebook employees do. Yes. I really believe that. And all of the work that we've done with large enterprises, vast majority want to feel like they're contributing to society and contributing to the world and being ethical.
Absolutely.
But at that same company, if you look at the antitrust committees that went before Congress, there's a Facebook employee that said, listen, when I'm building the algorithms, the pressure that was on me was to increase engagement by the second because we could monetize those seconds. And all of the hierarchical pressure on top of them was based upon moving that one number, ethics be damned. And so what you're automatically going to get is a disconnect between that and this vision of the communities and people being happier. And you're going to have these algorithms and these, and this mentality that, you know, sells diet pills to anorexics, sells, you know, gay therapy advertisements to the LGBTQ community. I mean, these things that are just so obviously counter to what society's morals are that, you know, there's, it's gotta be a conscious action that's taken to rebalance that.
Yeah. You know, Brant, one of the things I work with teams and leaders on a lot, and in fact, I have written a number of pieces where the whole point is this is your number one job as a leader. And it's what I call creating and keeping present the empowering context. And I think that is a, you know, these two things are very, very integrated and twined. And if Facebook, for example, were able to really keep that empowering context of creating communities. I mean, and maybe we put some modifiers in there like happy, engaged, or, you know, like loving, contributing communities, you know, versus just communities. Like the more that that empowering context is present, I think it starts to impact the ethics and the integrity of the whole organization, you know.
I totally agree.
Cause like the way, one of the things about integrity is that it's always going out, right? Like it's like a bicycle tire rolling by itself. Like you got to keep putting in a little energy there. Or it's just going to fall over one way or the other. And that became much easier for me when I started really being in touch with the empowering context around whatever integrity challenges I was having. Like, look, for me, it was being on time, right? Like I had a hard, cause I'm from LA. I mean, you know, supposed to be late, and I was resisting my dad, the Marine, who was 15 minutes early to everything. And when I finally got that, okay, number one, you know, it's just kind of disrespectful, but number two, out of two people who would be later on time, one's late, one's on time, which one of those people gets that they make a difference?
Yeah, no,
You know, the one who's on time, right? The one who's late doesn't think they make a difference. And guess what? I think I make a difference. In fact, I even if I don't, I want to make a difference. So all of a sudden, I started showing up on time. So my integrity was tremendously bolstered by that empowering context for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, and can you imagine? I mean, I guess you can't imagine because you're creating these leaders. But I mean, for leaders being able to share stories like that with their people, right? That's modern management. That's the type of management we need in the 21st century.
Yeah.
I think that if we think about like structurally inside of companies, if what managers have to do is worry about the tasks that their people are performing on a daily basis, they're never going to get to the point that they can be vulnerable and share stories like that, that are actually teaching these people how to better themselves and feel better about themselves and be happier and then therefore more productive. And so, maybe it's a pipe dream, but one of my ideas is, again, back to the team. If you build that sort of social structure and you're telling that to the team, then the team will reinforce those messages. It's not on the manager to do it one-on-one with eight people. You can do it once to the team, and the team itself, just based upon being social human beings, will reinforce that. And so it frees up the time for management and leaders to be proactive. They all want to be proactive. They're all feeling like they're too reactive. They all want to be more strategic. And I believe the way to do that is that the team is the new unit of work. You assign them a mission, whereas if all of your team's missions are accomplished, then you have accomplished your bigger mission, your larger contextual mission. And part of that mission is how we're going to measure the progress towards the outcomes. We're not just going to do KPIs based upon number of tasks, or we're not going to just talk about the outcomes, which is money or number of people. We need to get to the point that we can measure the progress towards that desired outcome. We're going to have regular share outs. And as a leader, I'm going to start mentoring rather than managing tasks, because we've built trust such that I believe that my team of smart people can solve problems without me managing every task. And so suddenly, you know, it just creates a virtuous cycle rather than one that sort of spirals downwards where we become, you know, if you're always reactive, you're only going to become more reactive.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to me, because listening to you makes me think about everybody that I've had on this show and that I've talked to in my work who comes from the military, right? And the military is one of those structures where I think the kind of the knee-jerk reaction is to think, oh yeah, they are top-down, command and control, right? Dude, couldn't be farther from the truth, you know? Yeah. Everyone that I've interviewed on this show and everybody that I've worked with and everything that I know about how the military works is just this, right? There's commander's intent, making sure everybody understands commander's intent. And then as a leader, the most successful military leaders are the ones who just get out of the way, right? They know what their people are good at. They empower that team. That team gets to work together to solve the problem. The commander just gets out of the way. And so I think it's interesting, because I think, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is they're command and control, but I think it couldn't be further from the truth. They've been doing hard things, dealing with change and disruption on the battlefield for, you know, a long, long time. And this is what it has evolved to for them, because it's what works.
Yeah, well, I think that my dad was a career Navy man, by the way, so we can keep the military theme going. But so... Yeah. General McChrystal's Team of Teams book to me is sort of the quintessential of what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's ways to fight war, which are very hierarchical and command and control. And, you know, when you're sort of rolling tanks across the desert, that tends to be pretty hierarchical, and people have very specific things that they must adhere to. And it's sort of like the same ethos as you hear in, you know, football teams or whatever. Right. But certainly, you know, the two institutions that come to mind that encounter this digital revolution world, this new world that we live in, is the military and healthcare. Very complex situations. And of course, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was not a traditional adversary, but is now sort of the new norm. And McChrystal led this effort to redo the military to fight an enemy like that based upon the same things that business and school and education and healthcare are facing. Yeah. The other analogy I like to think about, though, in terms of military is, you know, the special forces are a great example, right? So, you know, Extreme Ownership is a great book there, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to...
Jocko,
Right, yeah. So you're going to assemble an agile team with the skill set that is cross-functional or interdisciplinary in order to achieve the mission. So if you're writing back office code in engineering, maybe you can have eight people that all do the same thing. But if you're facing something more there's more uncertainty, then you have to build in this interdisciplinary nature.
Yeah.
There is different hierarchical levels of the people on the special forces squad. But at any moment, at any part phase of that mission that they're on, the expert in that particular domain is the leader. So it doesn't matter. The rank doesn't matter anymore, right?
Yeah.
And so that the leader actually changes throughout the mission. And that's what ultimately the group is measured by is the mission accomplished? And so I think that is also a great analogy for how one builds a team inside the modern enterprise. And again, the makeup of the team will differ depending upon the amount of uncertainty and sort of the time frame that one needs to accomplish a particular goal. And so in the book, Disruption Proof, there's a couple of case studies from really old, large companies that have assembled teams like that based upon the extraordinary things that they're trying to create in bringing new products to market and facing massive amounts of uncertainty. And so I haven't invented any of this. It's all coming, whether we like it or not. And so it's really the clarion call is to, you know, grab the bulls by the horn and be that change leader to make it happen inside your organization so you can thrive and survive.
So are there, then, you know, maybe the examples are too long to share here, and I definitely think people should go get your book. We're going to put a link to it. Is there a shorter story like that you can tell us around one of these companies and what they're doing and what's been working?
Well, so Roche Diagnostics, a very old medical device company in Europe.
Yeah.
They've been producing medical devices for, you know, that are digitized to some degree for decades, but they never communicated with each other. They didn't really come back to any sort of open repository of data. So the data wasn't really accessible. So they've decided that they're going to really reinvent themselves as a platform company. And so, you know, one of the leaders there, Moritz Hartmann, just, you know, super intelligent guy, super just kind of gets this entrepreneurial innovation mindset and just, you know, put his career on the line to go after this stuff and put together, boy, what I would say are seven squads of people pulled from all over the company. So it wasn't the innovation team or it wasn't, you know, the product team, but from all over the company. So that they're all areas of the company are represented. And we put them through a 90-day accelerator, which was just simply at an early definition phase, teaching them to go and talk to all the stakeholders, which of course in health sciences is very complicated. You've got patients, obviously, but you also have payers, healthcare providers, the labs, the IT that are at the labs. I mean, it just really goes on and on, and even stakeholders inside the company itself. And so going out and teaching them how to develop the empathy and understand the needs and the aspirations of all of those different stakeholders, running experiments to try to figure out which are the more critical aspects of it. And then adding on to, not only these seven or eight teams was a layer above team of teams. The title of McChrystal's book, right? So the team of teams is taking representation from the ground floor and you're adding this other layer whose job is to aggregate all of that information and ensure that we are achieving the priorities that the leadership is establishing. So you've got this layer then that is managing the resources and the missions below, but also has to manage the expectations and provide new information up. And you also then have to disseminate this information horizontally to the rest of the company. And so, you know, it all becomes quite complex, but again, what you're doing is empowering smart people, gating them, putting in the guardrails, putting some structure around it so that you're empowering them to go and do what they do, which is smart people solving problems.
Yeah.
And so really an extraordinary effort and really I think a model that, and I talk about in the book. And one of the key elements to it, which was also in McChrystal's book, is this conscious communications flow. You have to implement this communications flow. So a lot of scaled agile inside of large companies doesn't add that layer. They're so concerned with just the structure that they don't get into the behavioral components. But if your company is hierarchical top down, that means your communications typically flows one direction from top to bottom. And if you go and you convert to this agile team of teams or team is the unit of work, now the information is all being gathered and processed on the ground. And so you have to consciously put in these communications methods to get the flow correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really it's what I think about all day long. It all does come down to communication. If you can do all kinds of great work, and if the communication isn't there, it doesn't really matter that you did all that great work, because it doesn't end up amounting to much.
Right. You're not resilient. You're not aware, and you're not dynamic. I mean, it's just, it's great information, but it gets lost in the silos. And so, yeah, the very structure is to try to get rid of the silos so that it's easier to flow the information.
Well, it is interesting, right? Because that's one of the old tactics of the command and control world, is that person on the team who becomes the information bottleneck for job security,
Yep.
And that just does not work anymore,
No, I mean, it's really built into the incentives of those hierarchical businesses that everybody, it's not just communications, it's even expertise, right? I don't want to democratize my expertise because I'm going to democratize myself out of a job, is the fear. And so we really try to hold on to it. And then organizing companies around a function means that we're only managing tasks of that function, and we don't want interruption from the other departments. And so that's why we create all sorts of rules of engagement, that the other departments aren't even allowed to talk to us unless they follow this strict procedure. And again, that just slows us down, and it creates a bottleneck of the flow of information. So all of the, I really think it's almost amusing, but the very structure of our assembly line mindset that still dominates businesses today creates the behavior that makes us unable to be aware of changes and adapt to those changes quickly.
It reminds me of that saying that I love, which is, don't look for bad people, look for bad systems.
Yeah,
the systems
there's no
that
doubt
are
about
making
it.
The people bad, right? And so okay, let's say somebody's listening, maybe they're an entrepreneur, or maybe they're at a large corporation and they've got a little bit of they've got some pull and stuff. What do they need to be thinking now, Brad? Like, Brant,
it's actually quite different. So in the entrepreneurial world, I think that they're, hopefully, likely creating a fast moving organization that's, people wearing multiple hats, that whole thing. And they probably have introduced Agile already. Hopefully they bring it to the rest of the company. It doesn't have to be, super formal, rigid implementation of Agile, but read the manifesto and try to exhibit those behaviors and the sharing and the continuous improvement and all of that.
Yeah.
Well, so the startup entrepreneurs are going to get pressure from investors and advisors to start creating the structure that they see inside the large organizations. And so I think that one of the biggest missions for entrepreneurs is to resist that. That mindset that you have in your startup is one that you don't want to lose. You want to keep that. And the very structure and the policies, the processes that you put in place to scale often, go like, okay, well, now we have to do it like everybody else. And it's just not the case. And so, look at some of the other big successful tech companies and you'll see that. Yeah. For the large influential change agent inside of the corporation, job one really is to find like-minded people. Start a weekly or biweekly happy hour or some sort of other meetup that talks about some of these things, and make sure that you know who your allies are. And then start, I like the idea of running what I call impactathons, which are like hackathons, except you're really just trying to get people to behave in this particular way of empathy and exploration and all the rest. And do it over the weekend. See if you can get people to show up or go get a little bit of funding to do it, during the week. But don't go and try to hack together products. Go to leadership, find out what keeps them up at night, find out what some of their near-term uncertainties are, and use those principles to drive impact for leadership that owns budget. And that's as a way to demonstrate the ethos, demonstrate that behavior, that you can actually increase efficiency and increase productivity and figure out gaps in your business model because of the pandemic or some other disruption. And the idea really is to drive some near-term impact in order to demonstrate that this behavior is the right way to go. And I think what you'll see is that if you can do that and create a program around that, that you'll start seeing business units going like, we need some of that here. We need to move faster. We need to be more agile. And so to me, that's sort of the you know, it's, again, it's sort of eating your own dog food. It's bringing evidence. You're not going to go to senior leadership and go, hey, I got this great idea. We ought to do X, Y, Z. It's like, hey, we did this and we generated this amount of impact. And now we're asking for budget in order to scale it.
Yeah, I love that. That's really great. So changing subject a little bit, who are some of the influential leaders, you know, who are some of the big influences on you looking back over, you know, how you got into this and why you care about this and all that?
Yeah. So there are a number of, you know, sort of eye-opening experiences over the career. You know, I would have to go back to Steve Blank as being, you know, probably the first one who his four steps to the epiphany was really,
that is,
yeah. I mean, it's just, anybody that's worked in an entrepreneurial fashion looks at that and goes like, oh my gosh, this is the first time I've seen all this written down. And so,
I think I might have heard him speak because of you, Grant, in San Diego. Did you ever bring him to something?
I did bring him to San Diego.
Okay, so I left that with, I need to thank you for that, because that utterly, completely, I mean, in just no uncertain terms, altered my perception of my own value.
Wow.
And I remember the story he told about starting that company, like he's going to start a new company. And this time he was going to get the number one sales guy. So he went after the guy at wherever, IBM or whatever, and brought him on and thought this was just going to solve all the problems. And they went and did their first pitch. And when they came out, it clearly wasn't perfect yet. So he said, hey, listen, you drive, I'm going to make changes to the deck. And the guy almost hyperventilated. He's like, you can't change the deck. You can't change the deck. I can't present if you change the deck, you know? And I was like, oh, right. You know, like, and I just got like, oh, okay. Like,
I can't believe I can't believe he told that story. And then I made the same exact mistake. Ugh.
Did you?
I did. But yeah,
well, sometimes we got to learn it for ourselves.
Oh my gosh. I think that's what's the funniest thing about this. And you and I are, we can joke about this, but I mean, the people that really do get this stuff are the people that have failed at some level.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I just never got that my ability to go with the flow and like change the deck between this presentation and the next presentation, like all that stuff's like, that's just, of course, you know?
Yeah. It's quintessential learning mode, right?
Yeah. And I don't think I could do a very good job doing what that top sales guy at IBM did either. You know, right. It's not like, it's just two different things. And boy, that was just a huge aha moment for me in appreciating myself, which meant that, you know, I was able to step into much bigger things and take on much bigger things, understand myself better, you know. So that was a huge moment. So Steve Blank, through you, made an enormous difference for me too.
Yeah, it's funny. That's like, even before Steve Blank, we used to call that the Renaissance salesperson versus the turnkey salesperson. And you can easily confuse the two, because the turnkey often has the big numbers.
Right.
But so back to the influencers, I think that there, you know, a couple of others that I might mention, you know, Clayton Christensen, I mentioned already. And so I think that, you know, his The Innovator's Dilemma in particular, opening up the book around the mindsets that are sort of stuck inside of corporations. And again, I think that remains true. I just think the diagnosis or how to fix it is a little bit different today for most companies. I think, you know, in terms of leadership, I have not liked all of her books, but Brené Brown's Dare to Lead was just absolutely extraordinary. And I think for the first time used words that were sort of considered woo-woo in a way that was like, no, this is to drive business impact. And so I even struggled inside my own business as I was trying to, you know, my coaches are out teaching how to develop empathy for customers, but it was really Brené Brown bringing, you know, this idea of, you know, sort of rumbling, but rumbling with respect, which really drove it home to me that this is still in service to the business driving impact. This is not just so we can all feel good. We're not going and developing empathy because we all just need a moment, you know, where we're all holding hands and singing Kumbaya, right?
Yeah.
And so, even if that's all good, fine and good, I'm not like necessarily dissing that, but it's really that we want to make sure that it's in service to the impact that we're driving. And so the people that, Dr. Brown was working with inside of the corporations are high performance and super intelligent people that are like working like crazy. And what she's saying is you have to bring evidence to the table, and you have to be able to, you know, back up what you're saying, and you have to be able to rumble, but we also have to do it with respect and, being willing to expose our own vulnerabilities and, to bring empathy and those type of things. And so it's not this sort of either or. We've got to be, you know, again, command and control and tough guy and shout down the opponent. And we also don't have to be kumbaya. It's taking some of these real leadership elements that are just paramount in the 21st century and applying them to drive impact to the business. And I thought Brené Brown just like nailed it with Dare to Lead, in my opinion.
Yeah. So I'm a huge fan. Yeah. Plus one. Yeah.
And so again, I think that the other influence to me was, I think I've already mentioned was McChrystal's Team of Teams. I just think that my personal opinion is that I don't think that he's nailed how to bring it to corporates, but that's fine. That's not really his domain. I think that one of the things that drove home to me that this was bigger than, you know, the lean entrepreneur, to be honest, bigger than what Moves the Needle was up to, was when you can start seeing in all of these different institutions, this same change that's going on, or this same need for change. And so, you know, I've got this conference coming up on September 30th, and what we're trying to do there, it's called Endless Disruption, is highlight these changes in different elements of society, in education, in healthcare, in government, as well as business, and how we're funding startups, that these changes, if we pull back far enough, if we were standing on the moon and could look at this, we could see that these are fundamental changes that are going on in society. And the changes that we're talking about in business are just one element of that. I don't think this is reversible. It's going in one direction. And again, it's really just whether we jump on board, you know, grab the bull by the horns and make sure that we're making this work for everybody. I think that that's really the big challenge, is if we just sit back and let it happen, then, we're going to have this, you know, 0.1% that's going to get all the benefits from technology. There's a funny meme. I don't know if you've seen this, John, but there's this meme on YouTube that the Jetsons and the Flintstones actually occupied Earth at the same time.
Same time.
And right. And so that, you know, you've got this you know, entity that's existing above the Earth, and the rest is, you know, back into prehistoric times. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly not far off, is it?
Yeah. It could certainly go that way for sure.
Well, you know, I think that you're one of the bright stars in making sure it goes a way that's going to work for everybody, as opposed to the other way. And I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you being in my life, and I appreciate you taking the time to join me here and share all this great stuff. Is there anything that we didn't go into? Like, is there anything else that you want people to know? Or is there another concept that we could talk about for a minute before we go?
Yeah, I don't know. I appreciate you saying that, John. I think that the leadership side of it is super important. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I write about in the book is that I think most companies, and really probably most organizations, already have the people inside their company that are already behaving this way or want to behave this way. And I think that that's often an element that's missed, is that, oh, we have to bring in the big consultants, or we have to bring in, well, heck, even Moves the Needle or all of these other people. I think that there's a lot of agencies that can help, but I do think that there's a primary message to leadership that you already have the people. And so, to be honest, if you already have the people and it's not happening, then you have to look at something else. And I think, you know, you're the one that mentioned this earlier, is that it's not about the people. It's about the systems and the processes and the structure. And so we have to look at those layers. And I think that, you know, really in particular over the last 10 years, we've had a lot of the design thinking and agile and, you know, a change and rise in product management that brings some of these principles that is just great. We have leaders that are going through, you know, programs like yours and reading Brené Brown's books. And there's a lot of energy at the top with the leaders. And there's this ignored middle, the middle manager, you know, it's even like, it's something that's anathema, you know, is like middle management. And they play such a crucial role. And I really think that that's the next frontier. I feel like I need to concentrate on that. I think ultimately, if we restructure the companies, it's going to be flatter, but it's not going to go away. There's still somewhat of a hierarchy, and the middle management is key to that team of teams that I was talking about, of providing the larger context of what the ground layer is doing, of ensuring that that the communications flow is operating correctly. They're responsible for, you know, assigning the missions and the resources onto the teams that have these missions. They're responsible for coming up with the right metrics. They're responsible for aligning the work that's being done to the priorities. And so it ends up being this crucial part of the company that I think has largely been ignored, and they tend to still be incentivized incorrectly. And so that's really the bottleneck right now, is you've got people that want to behave this way. You've got leaders making the clarion call, we have to change. And yet we have these layers of middle management that haven't received the attention that they deserve and need in order to take that next step. And I really think if we're successful at taking that next step in that those middle layers, is that the change is going to start happening quickly, because I think that's really just the fundamental next bottleneck.
Yeah, I think that's a really good insight. And I think that what we're seeing now with, companies having a hard time retaining talent, having a hard time bringing in talent, with the competition really going up for that kind of stuff, that just becomes an even more important message and a more important thing to think about. You know, how can
you? I think that's a great point. I think that that's the layer that actually is moving horizontally now. I think that, and it's really amazing, just to throw another wrench in that, is the whole work from home, right? I mean,
let's talk about that for a second, because we didn't talk about that yet. And that's just such an elephant in the room, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, the media would have you believe that all young people want to work remotely or from home, and all management wants to work from the office. Uh-huh. And it's just not true. It's an easy, it's like classic media that I want a really super easy picture to paint so I can write about it. But it's way more complex from that. You've got young people that actually want the visibility. They want the social aspect. They want mentorship. And so they feel like they need to come into the office to get that. They don't want to commute for an hour, but let's set that aside for a moment. And then you've got more senior people who have paid their dues. They actually work there. They've got a great home office setup, right? Which a lot of younger people don't have. And so they want the ability to work from home, and maybe not every day, but sometimes. And so I think what the glaring shortfall here is, John, is how the companies believe that they can, again, make these policies inside the boardroom table, that it's sort of this one size fits all, remote, in office, or a very fixed hybrid approach, rather than taking the time to develop empathy for the different needs that your different workers have. And again, it doesn't mean implementing policies that solve all of their needs, but it's making you aware of them. You should at least understand what the implications of your policies are, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Running experiments to try to figure out what works, and using that evidence to design a flexible program that contributes to the happiness and therefore the productivity of all your employees. The concept is not that difficult, in my opinion. They can even just go have their innovation team do all of this work, because they know how to do it. But somehow it harkens back to that command and control era, where it's like, I'm the boss, so I'm supposed to make this decision. So I'm going to make this decision how I always have. And absolutely extraordinary, Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, coming around and go, nope, everybody's got to come into the office. I personally love coming into the office. Yeah. I love the serendipity of bumping into people. I love the energy. And you're sitting there thinking, your young new software engineer, you know, that's huddled in their cube with their headphones on is not experiencing in office like yeah. you are, Mr. Cook. Yeah. And yeah. so the engineers are all like, no, that's a deal breaker. I'll just go work somewhere else. And so it's just extraordinary to yeah. me that here's this opportunity to apply these five elements and actually come up with a plan that increases the productivity and efficiency of your business.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think we're going to see people, empathetic companies, the companies that are applying this stuff and really thinking about it. I think we're going to see some really interesting stuff that we maybe can't even imagine yet, you know?
I agree with that.
One of the things that I really do think, and I'd love your opinion on it, is look, this is just disclaimer. This is slightly self-serving because this is something I'm already starting to think about programs for. But I have a feeling that there are going to be a significant number of companies that are going to dramatically reduce their office expenses and not eliminate them. People are going to come in sometimes and people will figure out what the rhythms are and what makes sense and how they can still have some serendipity and yet avoid commute time. But then I think that we're going to see companies taking some of that real estate savings and putting it into, and I don't even know what to call them yet. Maybe we can coin a term right here, but let's all go to that beautiful resort location and let's have like a long weekend of being together and, you know, do some fun stuff, do some learning, do a little bit of work, but not a lot of work, like to replace that, the social bonds and the social cohesion that not being in the office altogether is going to have some impact on, right? But if you got the team together twice a year for something like that, where it was really distilled together time and you did some great, I mean, and I kind of hate the term team building, but it's actually really awesome when it's done right. Do some team building exercises, do some get to know each other better exercises, do some cross-functional innovation exercises. That could be a super blast. Could jumpstart productivity over just having everybody come to the office every day. You know?
Boy, I'd love to hear what you're working on because I'm right there with you. You know, a couple of years ago, my company was up to 17 or 18 people, and we would do that. We would try to do it a couple of times a year. Often it would just end up being one time a year. Actually, we were pretty uh-huh. good about it, two times a year. Uh-huh. We bring everybody together. And so I think that the size matters, right? There's really no reason why you need to do thousands of people. You keep it down to a level, almost like Bezos' two pizza teams, but maybe it's two pizza teams times two or times three.
Yeah.
We would run an unconference. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the unconferences, but that would allow the individuals themselves to tackle issues that their part of the organization is facing, which is absolutely brilliant. Brings in sort of that interdisciplinary way that you're getting ideas and ways of solving problems that are outside of your tight circle there. So there's all sorts of benefits to that. The social aspect part of it is huge. We were 100% distributed remote company, so we felt like we needed to bring people together. Yeah. The social aspect was great. We also implemented something we called the Jam Fund, which was a bucket of money that was always sitting there for one or two teams a month to pull money from that and travel to a location, go into a co-working spot in order to jam on a particular project where they felt like they would, you know, quote unquote, move the needle better by working together in person, focus time on that. So the Jam Fund is sort of another interesting way of doing that. So I think that's
a great idea.
Yeah,
all of those are great.
Companies like Buffer share their stories. They're also 100% distributed, and they're up over, I don't know, 100, 200 people. And so part of the problem is how do we share all of these ideas? But I think you're exactly right. And so again, that hierarchical decision making, you know, the leaders sitting in the boardroom going, how are we going to handle this remote stuff? They don't even consider the fact that there are all of these other ways to build strong teams, strong social, strong I don't know, ethos that we want to help drive the company forward without forcing people to commute for 30 minutes or 40 minutes. Or I guess there's some studies that say that people want to commute for 30 minutes, but that's fine. Yeah. Send them all into co-working spaces instead of, you know, creating all the traffic problems downtown. So there's so many solutions out there, but the solutions are going to come from the edge. They're going to come from the people that are out there in the world, not from the conference room boardroom table.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so, I mean, it is definitely, it's, we're definitely heading into something different, I think. And as you and I are talking, we're at that place where, you know, we're back to mid-pandemic levels of hospitalizations and things like that. And I think, like we were saying earlier, just because COVID ends up getting handled someday doesn't mean there's not another two or three or four or five disruptions right around the corner. You know,
there had to be half a dozen just in the last year. So I mean, it's not all will affect all, but you know, yours is coming for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, yours is coming. I think that's a really great, I think that's a great note to wrap it up on, because that is definitely something that I think is worth bearing in mind.
Yeah.
And people can find Disruption Proof on Amazon. I think it's already, I'm not sure exactly what day this will be dropping on, but it's already up for pre-sale, and that's always good.
Yeah.
So anything else you'd like to say in closing, Brandt?
Well, sure. So, you know, if you want to go to your favorite retailer, you can order it there. There's, you know, Amazon for sure. My website, BrantCooper.com, has some bundles there. So some special bundles you won't find at your retailers that include things like a workshop or just having me come in and speak, a book club type of thing. And so happy to do that with groups and organizations.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Launching a book tour. So you can go to BrantCooper.com to find out if I'm doing a virtual stop in your city.
I love that, by the way. I do think that's hilarious and awesome.
Yeah, it's really, that's almost its own subject, trying to sell that idea to publishers and the bookstores, because it's so like they don't grok it. But the idea is to actually push book sales through independent booksellers. And so, you know, LA, September 8th, and hopefully coming to Salt Lake City, John, and you'll be able participate. And so we've got a bunch of cities that are already scheduled, and we're going to push the book sales through the local independent bookstores.
Love that idea, Brent. I think that's so great. You know, I mean, and one of the things that that I always wanted to do, couldn't quite talk people into doing it, but if you're going to, like, I think it would be cool at this virtual event that's supposedly location-based virtual event.
Right.
Have a little bit of time for people to be able to network and say hi. Cause you know, it's like, I had to go to this virtual event to meet somebody who lives just down the street from me. But how often does that kind of thing happen? You know? So I think there'd be some local benefit to that serendipity potentially.
Yeah. That it kind of all depends upon the platform that the bookstores are running the event on.
Okay,
Our summit on the 30th, which you can also find more information on endlessdisruption.com, that will have networking there. Of course, it's not so regional anymore. But no, I totally agree with you. And I think that's one of the things that obviously people are eager to get back to is, how do I know the people that are around me, not just on the Zoom call? So,
yeah. Well, there's Endless Disruption, which is coming September 30th.
That's
and
right.
People can go to endlessdisruption.com.
And a ticket gets you the book there too, if you want to do it that way. Yep.
Okay. That's great. And BrantCooper.com has bundles has the book tour coming. So you can get the book through a local bookstore if you'd like to support them. I think that's awesome. And if you just want to laze out, you can go to Amazon and pre-order it.
Right. That's okay too. And also, you know, just generally, I like to say, you know, I'm Brandt Cooper on all social media, so hit me up. But also my email is brandt@brandtcooper.com. And I really do reply to all emails that don't go to spam. So
there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, so thank you very much for coming on with me, Brandt. It's been great talking to you. Congratulations on the new book coming out. I know how much work that must have been. And thanks for putting it all together so it can serve us, whether you're around or you're sleeping or you're doing something else, or like we can, you know, you can make a difference for us and you don't even have to be there. So that's, I love that about books.
Yeah. Thank you, John.
And yeah, so we'll make sure we get this out in time so that people can catch you on all those things. And, you know, look forward to hearing how it's all going. Please keep in touch. Obviously you will. And to everyone who joined us today, thanks for coming. Thanks for sticking around. And Brant Cooper, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure all mine. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you for joining the Speak Like a Leader podcast. Go be awesome.